Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
I'm sure that you know that if the New Testament is inerrant, obviously Jesus has risen from the dead. Now, if the New Testament is not inerrant, but only a good source for ethics and historical data, then Jesus likewise has been raised from the dead. But you probably didn't know that if the New Testament is not inerrant, nor historically reliable, but only a book of ancient religious literature, then Jesus has still been risen from the dead. You go, what? If it's not inerrant or historically reliable, how do you get to the idea that Jesus has resurrected from the dead? How can we do that? Well, there's no better person on the planet to talk about this than the great Dr. Gary Habermas, who, if you've listened to this program at all before, we talk about Gary a lot. He's been on the program a few times, and he's been studying the resurrection for about 40 years. He's been teaching at Liberty for nearly that long. He's recently appeared in two apologetics movies, God's Not Dead 2 and The Case for Christ. And there is not a person, I'm not exaggerating, there's not a person on the planet that knows this subject better than Gary Habermas. He has his PhD from Michigan State University. And by the way, when he was doing his dissertation on the resurrection, he was told specifically that he could not use the New Testament as evidence unless the individual passages could be affirmed by ordinary critical standards apart from faith. And yet Gary concluded that even with that restraint, Jesus had resurrected from the dead, and he's here to talk about it. And he's also here to mention that there's going to be an online course that starts next week, July 20th. Gary's going to be the main teacher for this thing, and you're going to want to be a part of it. We'll tell you a little bit more about that as the program unfolds. It's off our website, crossexamine.org. But without further ado, the great Gary Habermas. Gary, how you been?
Well, great, Frank Turek. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, sir, but I'll get better. And Gary, I know I've told this to people before. You're one of my favorite people in apologetics. In fact, you're one of my favorite people, period. But I got to ask you, in this course you're about to teach, you say if the New Testament's inerrant, Jesus has raised from the he's risen from the dead. If it's not inerrant, but just historically reliable, he's risen from the dead. But how can it be, Gary, that if the New Testament's not inerrant or historically reliable, that you still conclude that Jesus has risen from the dead? How can that be?
Well, that's a great question, Frank. It really is. But I mean, and I could come at it from different angles. But to say it from an angle that maybe makes the most sense to people, just so the light switch kind of goes on, think of it this way. What if someone did a master's degree in history and their thesis was to take one of the works of Homer, say the Iliad or the Odyssey, and to do a master's thesis on how much of this book or a portion of the book can be known as history, even though it's poetry, even though it is way, way centuries older than the New Testament? And how do we know which events are there? I mean, now this thing is, I understand, getting pretty close to getting cleared up. But I mean, for example, what do we say about Troy? What do we say about the Trojan horse? Can we know about those things? So, if my point is, if Homer is a poem and is hundreds of years BC, how can we pick any history out? Well, I'll bet you somebody's done master's thesis on it. I'll bet you somebody's done PhD dissertations on it. How do we do that? Because there are principles for digging out history, even in books that are lousy history books. You get a lousy history book, But if it purports to be about something of the past, we fancy that we can still learn something about it. And so it is with the New Testament. Another way to answer your question is like this. Critics of all stripes, let's go from the left and move over, atheists, agnostics, other kinds of skeptics, middle-of-the-road kind of guys. Yeah, New Testament's pretty decent, but there's a lot of issues. And then people holding different views of inspiration all the way over to the right. And you mentioned inerrancy. Okay, someone way over on the right. All of those views, I'm guessing that most of the time, the more you move to the left, the shorter your list of facts is going to be. Mm. But what I'm arguing is when you get to the far left, in fact, talking to atheists and agnostics, they're among my very, very favorite to talk to because they concede so much. They understand how those that are trained historically understand how history works. And my argument is they allow enough data to show that the resurrection is the best explanation for what comparatively little we know, according to their view.
Wow. And those are atheists and agnostics and skeptics admitting enough facts about Jesus and the data that we get, not only from the New Testament documents, from other sources.
Sure.
They're admitting certain facts about the resurrection. Now, you have been a champion of this minimal facts approach that you developed. I guess this came out of your dissertation, didn't it?
It did. But if you went back and looked at my dissertation, I off the top of my head, I don't know how many pages, because I go back to it a couple times. But I might only have 5 or 8, 10 pages out of 350 on this subject. So the rest of the argument is doing things with more or less what we might call reliability arguments. You know, for the middle of the road, for the guy who says, yeah, I'm not a Christian or anything, but I think the Testament's pretty decent. Say like a Roman historian, like Sherwin White, A.N. Sherwin White, there's a good example, who might give you a fair amount of data. I did my dissertation mostly with those kind of guys, but I do have this minimal fact section, which I actually didn't realize how strong the argument was at the time, 1976, and I've been developing that portion of the dissertation ever since.
Well, you must have been a pretty studious fellow to get your dissertation in 1976, because you were only 26 at the time, weren't you? How did you get it so quickly?
Now, I was 26 soon afterwards, but technically 25 when it was done. Yeah, and you know what? And people will tease around with me, anybody who knows me, and they'll say, and they know it really bugs me, so they say all the more, but they'll say, oh, so that makes you some kind of nerd that you had finished your PhD by age 25. And I'll say, hey, by the way, I took a whole year off school, a whole year with doing nothing, or I've been 24. And that just kind of blows their mind. And I go, yeah, but just a few years before that, in my late teens, I played hockey almost every day when I got home from school. So my life was sports, football and hockey in particular, dating. And I ended up getting married at 22. So I was married when I finished my PhD. So dating, sports. And when the day was over at 10 o'clock, I didn't feel like doing my schoolwork because I didn't like anything I was studying. So about 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night when I came in from my sports, I'd go, okay, where'd I leave off? And there would the apologetics would pop up, and I'd work on it for 5 hours till 2 o'clock in the morning. And that's where I also had my very bad habits of staying up half the night.
Well, we're going to talk about those habits and how they ultimately resulted in this very formidable argument for the resurrection and how you can learn more about it with this new online course. In fact, if you go to crossexamine.org and you click on resources at the top, you'll see online courses, Resurrection of Jesus. It starts online July 20th. You want to be a part of this. Gary's the teacher, and you're going to be able to ask him questions live. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but this is an amazing opportunity, and we're going to talk more about this, particularly the resurrection and how do we know it's true in just a couple of minutes. I'm Frank Turek. We're back in just 2 minutes.
Thank you for listening to the Cross Examine podcast. This material is made available to you for free by the contributions of listeners like you. If you wish to support future podcasts, just go to crossexamine.org and click on the donate button, or simply use the donate feature directly on our app. Thanks.
If you're low on the FM dial looking for National Public Radio, go no further. We're actually going to tell you the truth here. That's our intent anyway. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. And if you go there and you click on resources, you'll see online courses off to the right. You'll see Resurrection of Jesus, and Gary Habermas. Yes, the Gary Habermas is teaching a 30-hour video course on that subject, the Resurrection of Jesus. You can be a part of it. And indeed, there's going to be three one-hour periods during the 6-week course where you're going to be able to ask Gary questions live via this technology called Zoom. It's like Skype, but you can have 100 people on it. And you can interact with Gary on this amazing subject. Really, there's only two questions in Christianity. I mean, two big questions to see if it's true. Question number one, does God exist? And number two, did Jesus rise from the dead? The world-renowned expert on the resurrection is talking about, did Jesus rise from the dead? And you can be a part of it. So check it out at crossexamine.org. Again, click on resources and online courses. And there are 30 segments, half-hour segments here. Basically, you got to watch a half-hour video a day. You'll get a workbook that goes with it. I'm looking at the workbook right now. It's amazing what you cover in here, Gary. I mean, you're covering objections to the resurrection, principles of history. How do you determine how do you discover what is true in history? Methodologies. You're talking about the minimal facts method. You're talking about naturalistic alternative theories to the resurrection. You go through all that stuff. You talk about understanding the skeptical mind, evidence for the death of Jesus, the appearance of Jesus, the empty tomb. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And also about how you ground your theology in the resurrection and what the resurrection really means. So this course is going to be incredible. I'm going to take it myself. I'm going to be online listening to you teach this, watching you teach this, and then we'll have the opportunity to ask questions. Now, Gary, I mean, you talk about how the evidence is good that even the atheists will admit that 90 to 95% of scholars will give you certain minimal facts. What are, say, three or four of these minimal facts that 90 to 95% of scholars agree on?
By the way, when I say 95%, I don't put a percent, but when I say 90-something percentile of scholars, here's my only prerequisite. They've got to be scholars in a relevant field. Uh-huh. Like, I can't say, I'm a scholar, I've got a PhD in engineering. Well, a PhD in engineering is fantastic. The guy's probably absolutely brilliant. He probably does math circles around 99% of the population. But I'm only, when I say scholars, I mean guys who specialize in these areas. That's still a big group. That would be like New Testament guys. I think probably Old Testament guys at least understand enough stuff that they could jump in there too. Classical scholars, historians, philosophers, archaeologists. These are some of the people that I would say their fields are close enough that they'd be able to wade right in here. But I do want to say that because somebody listening could say, well, I don't grant that, and I'm a scholar, and what's your area? And it's like medicine. Well, medicine's huge, and that should help you with the death of Jesus, but it's right. Not going to, you know, I bet you haven't seen bodies get up from the dead, so that's pretty tough. You know what, Frank? I'll name, I usually use six. I've used anywhere from 3 to 7, but I'll do six real fast.
All right.
The first one's not an evidence for the resurrection, but it's a prerequisite for the resurrection. You have to have a death. So Jesus' death by crucifixion is number one. Number two, I would say that the fact that the disciples had real experiences, conceded by everyone, real experiences that they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus. Number three, these appearances turned their lives upside down, and it turned their lives upside down to the extent that they were willing to die for their faith. Now, I'm very happy, and in my lectures that you're talking about, I do this in detail, but I'm willing to talk about the martyrdoms of a number of them. But the point I make overall is, I only have to say, that their lives were transformed to the point that they were willing to die for your faith. Someone said, well, what? Can you get inside their head? No, they're willing to die for their faith. Just look at what they do. They continue to put themselves in situations where they could very easily die, and many times they get roughed up and or left for dead or killed. I mean, you know, you got Paul being stoned and beaten 40 minus one lashes three times. I mean, that's putting yourself in the way of great harm. And so that's that point, not proving that they all died. Fourthly is very important, and that is this event was proclaimed very early, very, very early. For somebody who says, well, yeah, but you only got a crucifixion and burial of Mark. We don't even have appearances. And he's still, 40 years after the fact. How do you get back further than that? Isn't Mark the earliest gospel? Well, most scholars say he is. All right, how do you get back? Well, Paul's 20 years earlier. Okay. All right, hadn't thought about that, but okay, now that you say that. So Paul's 20 years earlier. We're getting better. How do we go behind that? And we can talk about this, but there are early sources inside the gospels. Inside the New Testament, in the epistles. If we were doing them today, we would put footnotes there because these guys are footnoting somebody else's material. And sometimes they do footnote it in a sense. They say, here's a trustworthy saying, or they say, I got this from somebody else. So that's a footnote. But these things are proclaimed very early. I'm just reading Larry Hurtado last night, and Hurtado says the earliest preaching of this came probably months after the events itself.
How do they determine that, Gary? We'll go back to the minimal facts, but this is such a critical point. In effect, what you're saying here is that, well, the document, say 1 Corinthians 15 is written down in, say, 55, but you're saying that there are creeds and there's testimony of this that goes all the way back to, say, 30 AD. How do we know that?
Yep. By the way, you said I'll come back to them. I'll just say the other two in a sentence. The last two, 5 and 6. Are the conversions of two skeptics, Paul and James, the brother of Jesus, who were anything but Christians, and the lives of both of them were turned around because they too had experiences which they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus. So that's the six. Now back to the early. First, I do not argue. I want to be clear about this. I do not argue that since these real toughened atheist, agnostic type, since they will let you put these events back anywhere from, 1 to 3 years, the teaching of them, not the occurring, but the teaching of them, anywhere from 1 to 3 years after the cross, therefore it must be true. Mm-hmm. I never argue that since they grant it, it must be true. But I often start with who grants it, because if these guys are atheists or agnostics or skeptics, I can give a very impressive list of guys who are not going to argue with what I just said. You have to ask, if they are not believers, if those guys you just mentioned are agnostics, skeptics, atheists, why do they grant that? So you got to think somewhere, even if you haven't dug long enough or can't listen to the program long enough or don't want to read the whole book, you must realize that there's something there to make people who don't want to believe, who don't believe, and so on, accept these things. So I might sweeten the pot here by just saying skeptics, unbelievers, agnostics. Bart Ehrman, by the way, Bart Ehrman, best-known skeptic in North America, Bart Ehrman dates the preaching of these events in one form or another to 1 to 2 years after the cross. And he says there's many of them. There's a number of these, at least a half dozen of these one-liners in the New Testament from 1 to 2 years, let's say 1.5 years, after the cross. That's Bart Ehrman. Now you've got James Crossley, an agnostic and an unbeliever, will concede these. You've got Garrett Ludeman. I'm pretty sure that I was going to say John Dominic Crossan, but I'm almost positive he's called. I'm almost positive Dom called himself a Christian, so I wouldn't be able to put him in the agnostic atheist category. But anyway, everybody knows him as being pretty skeptical. Same thing with Marcus Borg, who unfortunately passed away. And we have others. We have a number of other people who are in that. So you have to wonder if these guys are the sharpest guy. Maurice Casey's another one. He passed away in 2014, but he was an unbeliever. You have to ask, why do these people grant these things? Mm. And there's a lot of reasons for it. But let me say this, Frank, one more just general comment. Today, it is the consensus position. I remember doing my research and saying, Paul got the material in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, here's one of probably the main way it's argued. There's more than one way to get there, but here's the main way. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, okay, stop. When was 1 Corinthians written?
53
A.D.
Yeah.
One of the top skeptics I just read just the other day backed it up to 53. So, okay. All right, so 1 Corinthians 53. Paul says in 15:3, he's quoting material that is not his. He specifically says, I gave you what I received. And by the way, he's using technical words for passed down tradition. He was a Pharisee, and that's how Pharisees taught, by passed down tradition. He says, I gave you what I was given. And it's believed by scholars, the consensus view is that he got this material 35 A.D. in Jerusalem from Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. Well, how do you get that date? Well, of the 13 books that bear Paul's name, seven of them are conceded by, if there's five critics, I mean, well-known scholars in this field who don't concede these seven, I'd like to know who they are.
Huh.
Bart Ehrman, of all people, calls them the unanimously conceded Pauline epistles. And those seven, by the way, just for the record, are Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, Philemon. In one of those books, Galatians, chapter 1, Paul says he went up to Jerusalem, and you can do the math. You say, well, how do you get 5 years after the cross? Here's how. When did Paul come to Christ? Well, the typical answer is 2 to 3 years after the cross. Take the latest one, take 3. And let's say he died in 30. Some people, the second most popular view is that he died in 33. It doesn't make a difference. Yeah, all you're going to do is move everything back. In fact, in some cases, it's going to be better for an argument to have a 33 crucifixion, but I think it's 30. And here's what you get.
Okay, hold the thought, Gary, because we're about to come up to the break, and this is the punchline, so we want to make sure we don't rush you through this.
We're talking
to the great Dr. Gary Habermas about the resurrection, the minimal facts approach to the resurrection, and there's a lot more than just the minimal facts in this new course Gary's going to be teaching. Go to crossexamine.org, click on resources, and you'll see online courses. The first menu item up there, you'll see the resurrection of Jesus. Gary's the teacher. For 30 hours of video, and then you can ask him questions live over video as well. We'll tell you more about that a little bit later. I'm Frank Turk. We're back in just 2 minutes. Don't go away. Jesus rose from the dead, even if the New Testament documents are not historically reliable. What? We're talking to Gary Habermas. He's telling us why, and you can learn a lot more detail-wise by taking the new course, The Resurrection of Jesus, with Dr. Gary Habermas. Just go to crossexamine.org. It starts July 20th, so you got to get on this quickly. If you're hearing this after the July 20th, yeah, you can join the course late. You can catch up. There's about 30 hours of video, half hour of video a day you get to look at. You can go faster if you want, but... and then there's a workbook, and you can interact with people in the class, and you can interact directly with Dr. Gary Habermas on three occasions, 3 one-hour Q&A sessions. But right now, he's our guest. And Gary, you were just pointing out how we get to a very early date for, say, the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, where even Bart Ehrman says the resurrection was preached very early in Christianity, say a year after the resurrection, maybe earlier, who knows. How do we get to that point?
Okay. And I was backing us up from 1 Corinthians 15, because
right.
1 Corinthians 15 is one of the, again, Bart Ehrman's words, undisputed Pauline epistles. So everyone's going to give them to you. And I'm only going to use two of them. 1 Corinthians 15, Galatians 1. By the way, this is a footnote. I like footnotes. There's a really skeptical German liberal scholar named Ferdinand Christian Bauer in the first third of the 19th century, German liberal, when German theology was really liberal. He would only grant four of Paul's epistles. Now, I'm talking about guys today who grant seven. But Bauer was so skeptical, he only granted four. Guess what? 1 Corinthians and Galatians. The only two books I'm going to use are in his four.
Okay.
So it's a great basis. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 3, he says, I gave you what I was given. And those are technical words for giving and passing on tradition. So since the reason Paul's epistles are taken so strongly is, I mean, Barberman doesn't for a minute think that Paul is inspired. But, well, then why is Paul authoritative? Why do they almost never argue with Paul? Well, because Paul has all the following characteristics. Paul's brilliant. If you can believe the statement in Acts, Paul would say, what we're saying is, Paul has a PhD in Old Testament under Gamaliel. I mean, the best scholar of that time, and Paul studied him under him. So Paul's brilliant. He's authoritative. He knows what's going on in the early church. He wouldn't lie because he was honest. Now, he could be wrong. Don't get me wrong. If you're one of these skeptics, Bart Ehrman, he could be wrong, but he's not going to intentionally mislead you. He's not going to lie.
Mm.
And here's the big thing. He's in the right time at the right place and knows the right people. And as Ehrman says, Ehrman's got a half a chapter on this. When Paul went to Jerusalem about 5 years after the cross, he met Peter and James. The whole theme of the short book of Galatians is the gospel. I often tell my grad students, here's the theme of the gospel. It's all about the gospel, which in the New Testament is always defined as at least the data, at least deity, death, resurrection of Jesus, and the question, do you want to make a commitment? Do you want to say, I do, to Jesus? Deity, death, resurrection, and are you ready to make a commitment? Get it right. Paul says, don't give too much, don't give too little. And he's coming there to talk to them in 35 AD. And here's how you get the plus five. Paul's conversion, we were saying, is about 2 to 3 years after the cross. You can put the cross at 30. Makes no difference if you put it at 33, which is second favorite date. Actually, you're going to be closer to the book of 1 Corinthians, 33. But, so Paul, Jesus is crucified in 30. Paul is converted about plus three, that's 33. And he says, 3 years later, Galatians chapter 1, verse 18, 3 years I went up to Jerusalem and spent 15 days, with Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. You go, well, that's 6 years after. Three plus three, you're right. But a lot of people date the conversion of Paul plus two. And if his conversion is plus two and not plus three, and he goes up there three years later, that's where we get the 35. And many, many scholars put this at 35. So he goes to Jerusalem. He spends 15 days with these guys. What's the main theme? Well, why is this in the book of Galatians, which is all about the gospel? Because he cannot get away. Come on. He can't get away 15 days with James and Peter and not ask about the nature of the gospel. What's the deity, death, resurrection of Jesus? If I'm Paul, here's my first question. I will tell you guys how he looked to me on the way to Damascus. Nobody here in Jerusalem shared my testimony before, not for me. I'll tell you, and you guys tell me, Peter, you denied him. James, you're an unbeliever. Sorry, guys. I was a persecutor, so we're on even ground here, bad ground. What did he look like to you the first time he appeared? And that would be my very first question. Tell me your testimony, guys. Got to hear it. Got to know what's going on in Jerusalem. And that's a plus five, maybe plus six. Now, not to miss the forest for the trees, how does Bart Ehrman get back? If it's plus five or six, how does Bart get back to 1 to 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's how. When Paul heard that, presumably from Peter and James, that is the consensus view, he is telling you when he heard their testimony. And by the way, there's a Greek word in Galatians 1:18. It's called hysteresi. And the Greek word, the root word is H-I-S-T-O-R, the Greek word from which we get the English word history. But I'm not going to argue that because that's where we get the word history. He has to be using history there. That's, we don't know that 2,000 years ago. But histor, or historesi, does mean checking things out firsthand. The word means to check something out. You know, in most of our places around the country, 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, depending on where you live, this program comes on all your main channels, and it's called the Eyewitness News. And that just means, you know, there's a storm. We're in Nebraska, but there's a hurricane down in Florida. And don't you know, we have our favorite reporter down there. Here he is right now. Boy, look at that, folks. He can't even stand still in front of the camera. Hope you don't get blown over, Bill. That's his historesi.
Okay.
He's on the scene checking it out. And Paul uses that word amazingly in Galatians chapter 1 for what he was doing. He plays the role of the hurricane tracker. That's what he's doing. Hmm. So he's in Jerusalem talking to maybe the two main guys and asks them about this gospel. But he hears it, plus 5. That's when he hears it. Now, two more steps. If James and Paul, I think we have to say, they knew their testimony before they told, James and Peter.
Uh-huh.
They would have to know their own testimony before they told Paul.
Right.
That's a given. So if Paul hears it at plus 5 or plus 6, we said, and they had it before Paul, well, when did you guys have this? Right after the crucifixion. That's when we saw him days later. Wow. So what you're telling me goes back 5 or 6 years. Yep. Back to the cross. We saw him. Remember, one of our principles is the disciples had experiences that they believe were appearances of the risen Jesus. And by the way, Larry Hurtado, the same guy I cited earlier, he says that those experiences happened just days after the crucifixion. That's the traditional 2 to 3 days after the cross. And so they say, yeah, we saw him. We saw him. So Paul hears it plus 5 or plus 6. They had their testimony before that. And the events on which their testimony is based goes all the way back to the crucifixion. So it's actually days later. And Bart Ehrman's asking the question, when are they starting to preach this material? When does this material in 1 Corinthians 15 get memorized and passed around orally? James D.G. Dunn, by the way, is an influential historical Jesus scholar as there is today. He says not more than that it was preached on, not experienced, preached just a few months after the cross. And Larry Hurtado says preached a few months after the cross, too. So you've got the whole thing there. If you work backwards, Paul heard it. They knew it before him. They experienced it way before that, back at the beginning of the events. But in between their experiencing and their telling Paul, they proclaimed it to other people at month's mark. So that's how they get back to 1 to 2 years. That's part of our mistake.
Now, this is just one aspect of the entire argument. And if you really want to dive into this stuff and know it as clearly as Gary knows it, you need to take this new course that Gary's teaching online. Go to crossexamine.org, click on resources, and you'll see online courses right there. You can bring Gary Habermas right into your living room. 30 hours of video plus 3 1-hour Q&A sessions live. You can be a part of it. There's 3 levels of courses you can take. If you take the premium version, you get Gary Habermas live. It's going to be amazing. I'm looking forward to it myself. And notice what Gary is saying here. Both Gary and myself believe in the inerrant Bible, but you don't need an inerrant Bible to show that Jesus has resurrected from the dead. And if Jesus has resurrected from the dead, then Christianity is true. It's the central fact in Christianity, aside from God existing, is the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. And you can show this is the case without assuming the New Testament documents are even historically reliable. And that's what Gary will show you how to do in this course. And Gary, I got to ask you, and maybe we'll finish it up after the break, but a guy like Bart Ehrman, He's got these facts, the minimal facts that you mentioned. What would his explanation be that explains these facts? If not a resurrection, he doesn't believe in the resurrection. What would his be his position? Would it be hallucinations? Where would he go?
Yeah, the puzzling thing is I've read a lot of Bart Ehrman, and the puzzling thing is he seems to adjust a little bit. And what the heck? I'd adjust too if I were him. I mean, if I picked a naturalistic theory and the theory seemed not to be working with recent data coming up and good arguments, I could change too. But all he's going to say is, so I want to change. I think there's a better theory out there. It's a very normal thing. And I would have to grant that. But I could be saying this incorrectly, but my understanding is a few years ago, Bart used to teach the hallucination theory. In his most recent book that I know of, in his most recent book, he says, I'm not going to take a theory anymore.
Oh, wait. We're going to talk about that after the break. Why wouldn't he take a theory? And how can you defend this yourself? We're going to talk more right after the break. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turk. My guest is the great Dr. Gary Habermas, the world-renowned expert on the resurrection. We're back in two.
If you find value in the content of this podcast, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where you can find more. Just type Cross Examine or Frank Turek on the search bar. Also, visit our website where we add new videos, articles, and free resources daily.
Man, time is at a premium when you're with the great Gary Habermas, man. We're just covering one point here. And there's so much more to cover. If you really want to get into this, this course, The Resurrection of Jesus, again, you got to go to crossexamine.org. It starts July 20th. Yeah, you can join it a little bit late if you're hearing this later than that. But go to crossexamine.org, click on online courses or resources, online courses. You'll see it there. Gary's your teacher, the world-renowned expert, 30 half-hour sessions over 6 weeks. So you watch one every day of the work week. For 30 minutes, you work out on the workbook a little bit. You have some interaction with the mentor in this course, a guy by the name of Michael Patton, who's a Dallas Theological Seminary grad, good friend of Gary's as well, who knows this material inside and out. And then you get 3 1-hour live sessions with Gary when you take the premium course. And Gary and I were just talking off the air. You don't need to ask Patty Cake questions. You can hit Gary with the best question you've ever heard or the most skeptical question you've ever heard. In fact, the one you just heard from your buddy down at work, who's a skeptic or an atheist, bring that to Gary because he's heard them all and he'll give you his best shot back. And I'm telling you, in this course, you're going to cover the entire resurrection story as best that can be covered in the amount of time. You're going to go from the importance of the resurrection to objections, to how to do history, to methodology, to minimal facts, to how the New Testament was completed, to all the naturalistic theories, including the stolen body, hallucinations, the swoon theory, the copycat theory, naturalistic theories that try and say the resurrection didn't occur, evidence for the death of Jesus, evidence for the appearances of Jesus, evidence for the empty tomb. It's all in here. Who did Jesus think he was? Why did he even come to earth? What's the whole point? And this is all going to be put together. It already has been put together. You can be a part of it. Go to crossexamine.org, click on online courses after you. It's right under the resources tab, resources, online courses, The Resurrection of Jesus. Sign up quickly if you want to be a part of this. Now, Gary, just before the break, you were talking about the skeptic Bart Ehrman, probably the top skeptic in the country, maybe the world, on the resurrection. He teaches at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you were saying that now he does not take an alternative theory. He does not believe the resurrection occurred, but he grants all these facts that seem to indicate that the resurrection did occur, and he won't take a naturalistic theory. He won't commit to one. Why not?
Well, I cautioned a little bit because I can tell you the book he does that in, it's his book, one of his latest ones, called How Jesus Became God. Mm-hmm. And he says in there, you don't need to take a naturalistic theory. And I think he pretty much implies that he's not going to take one. So, but his older stuff, he seems to lean toward hallucination. Now, the reason I'm a little hesitant is somebody told me, I don't read his blogs, But someone told me that he's blogging a little bit differently today. So I don't know if he's gone back to him. I don't know if he was, you know, I don't mean this critically, but I don't know if he used to hold the theory and then didn't hold the theory, but now he thinks he does or he can. I don't know where he is, but there has been some change. And I'll tell you another one he has changed on. Mike and I called the Mike Lacone and I, my co-author for one of my resurrection books. And Mike has written, I think, the best historical book of the resurrection there is with Inner Varsity. But Mike and I, in an earlier book, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, called the minimal facts. We do four instead of six there, and we call it 4+1 because the empty tomb has as many evidences in its favor as any of the facts, but doesn't have 90-something percentile agreement from skeptics. So we leave the empty tomb out. But the that doesn't mean the empty tomb can't be used. That doesn't mean it's not powerful. Bart has flipped on the empty tomb. He recently said in a recent book, I used to grant it. I don't grant it anymore. So whether it's the empty tomb or not, he has flipped a little bit. Anybody has a right to change their views. So I'm not saying anything about Bart. But I'm saying he does seem to have gone back and forth, and I think it's because I think he's either been nailed in debates, or he does some careful thinking, and he might have come up with some problems with these views on his own. And I think he notices these things. In fact, in the book I just mentioned, he says an amazing comment. He says, history can't prove the resurrection. Now, just about the time you're going to jump down his throat, you go, well, I guess I shouldn't be too nasty. He is an agnostic. I mean, I don't expect him to say, I believe Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, and you know, I confess him as my Savior. You don't expect him to say that. So he says, yeah, history can't prove the resurrection. But then he finishes the sentence, and history cannot disprove the resurrection either. I think that's an amazing comment from one of the world's best agnostics. You have to grant him the right to say he doesn't think we've proven our case. But to go on and say he doesn't think history disproves it? If I were an unbeliever playing a little Pascal's wager, and I didn't think you could prove it or you know, otherwise, and I had to change my view a couple times because some things were kind of tight, I'd be getting a little close to reality here, you know? So that's important for me.
Well, you know, I learned, a good distinction I just learned recently from my friend J. Warner Wallace, the cold case homicide detective, is he said, look, there's a difference between a fact and an inference. And a fact is the facts that that are granted, as you say, Gary, by even far left atheistic scholars are the minimal facts you mentioned earlier in the program. The question is, what best explains those facts? And that's the inference. And since we're open to a resurrection because we believe God exists on other grounds, we believe that the universe had a beginning, must have it a beginner, it's designed, you know, we've got the cosmological, the teleological arguments, the moral arguments, you know, the arguments from reason and consciousness and all these things that seem to be best explained by theism, we're open to God intervening in the world through a resurrection. Well, maybe Bart Ehrman is not. So our inference is, well, the best explanation is a resurrection. Bart's inference is, it can't be a resurrection because I've ruled that out in advance. I don't know what happened, but any alternative theory I take, and by the way, you're going to go through all these alternative theories in this course. Go to crossexamine.org, click on resources, and you'll see the online course Gary begins teaching that you can take on July 20th. He starts teaching it. You can be a part of it. Then you can ask questions of Gary live. The inference that he's drawing is it can't be a resurrection. I don't know what it is, but it's got to be something other than a resurrection. But that's a pretty bold admission by Bart to say you can't know either way.
And Frank, you make a really, really good point here. I know there's got to be some skeptics if they dare, you know, if they're listening to this program, they're going to say, you guys, you've not recognized the elephant in the room this entire time. And the elephant in this room is, okay, so there's some things in his favor, and yeah, you can find all six of these facts, and you used to be able to find the empty tomb in my own works, granted. But what are you asking me to do with it? You're asking me to say a man was raised from the dead. Last time I checked, men don't get raised from the dead in history. So your problem is, it's not just like the simplest hypothesis, like, you know, you think it is, but you're asking me to go outside this world to draw something from a realm that doesn't exist.
Yeah,
you're
but
asking
Gary,
me to go to the supernatural. And so your point about, if God, then you got to be open to resurrection. That's a great comeback. If God, you got to be, and I'll tell you another one. If something like near-death experiences happen, and I'm going to tell you, there may be no area of natural theology that is more evidential than NDEs. There are 300 evidential ones that are out there today, all empirical. And if there's an afterlife, what's so amazing about afterlife? I don't think NDEs are a miracle, I'll be clear. I don't think they're a miracle. But they do evidence another realm. You know, notice
right.
Naturalists don't believe in an afterlife.
Right.
And they do believe in another realm. And if you already say, wow, looks like there's an afterlife, then I say, well, then you need to be more open to resurrection. And they go, why? You're telling me Jesus had a near-death experience? No. Put two and two together. If NDEs show that there's an afterlife, even for a short period of time, you have to be open to the realm of afterlife. And what is resurrection, pray tell? Bingo, afterlife.
Well, you're an expert in that too, Gary.
That's why I deal with the two topics. That's why I deal with two of them. Because, and Frank, you do a lot more with God's existence. So I would say for someone who says, you're ignoring the elephant, why would I even think that this world is such as the supernatural? I go, okay, well, Frank, talk to him about your favorite arguments for God's existence. If God, God could raise the dead. Gary, what's your favorite? Oh, I'll talk about near-death experiences. And what realm was that? Are they miracles? Nope, they're not miracles. What are they? They're natural events. People rise from the dead, but that's the point. This is a world where people rise from the dead. So the supernatural impinges on this world. And now you can't shut your door to resurrection because you've already granted afterlife unless you want to go after NDEs.
And I think the other point they miss, Gary, is the fact that if resurrections occurred all the time, then the resurrection of Christ would mean nothing to us. It's got to be a rare event. That's the whole point.
Sure.
The whole point is the resurrection of Jesus is a singular event in history that's so well attested. But if people had been popping up from the dead all the time throughout history, the resurrection of Jesus would mean nothing. So it's got to be a rare event. And yet here are the skeptics ruling it out in advance precisely because it's a rare event.
Yeah, Gary, we want it to be rare.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Rare equals unique.
That's right.
If
now,
it's
Gary,
one of a kind, if it's one of a kind, whoever lived, and I'm talking about a resurrection toward immortal life where the person's still living today, not people who come back and die. Or even NDEs. If it is rare, and rare means unique, and unique means who is this guy who was raised from the dead? And the answer is, let me tell you about him.
Exactly. Gary, we're out of time here, but I got to
right,
tell people that they need to take this course that you're teaching, 30 hours of video, half hour at a time, plus 3 1-hour sessions with Gary live over Zoom. You can ask him any question you want. Bring your hardest question. It begins on July 20th. If you're hearing this after the fact, you want to join the course later, you can. Just go to crossexamine.org. Click on resources, online courses. You'll see it there. Gary is your teacher. You're not going to have a better opportunity than this. Gary, you're wonderful. Thanks for being on the show again.
Frank, thanks so much for being the world's best interviewer.
Gary, thanks. You are the man. Gary Habermas, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget about the course. You need to take it and get on it right now. Crossexamine.org. Resources, online courses. See you next time. God bless.